Hi, this is Leia from the Cancer Pod. This is a content warning. The following episode may involve subject matter that is sensitive to some people. We get it, and it's okay. We hope you join us on a future episode.
Hi, Tina.
Hi, Leia.
Sorry, I'm laughing. Laughing at the recording in progress, lady. Oh, what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to talk about nausea.
Nausea and vomiting.
Nausea and vomiting.
Before we talk about nausea and vomiting, I wanted to talk about what this next pod is about. So our next three episodes are about side effects, or as they are known in the cancerverse, as side effects. That's pretty good, right?
I like it.
I've just earned us an explicit warning.
All right. This is for mature audiences, apparently.
Yes. Tipper Gore would not be happy with me. So a little quick story behind where side effects comes from. I was on Twitter the other day and Thanks Cancer had tweeted something about side effects. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. We're doing these recordings. And so I was trying to come up with a clever name and asked if I could use it. And it turns out that there was a woman on Twitter. Her name is Katie Davidson. She was known as Lovely Katie Lumps. And she had metastatic breast cancer. And so she often used that term. And so it's thought that's where that originated. And so I just kind of wanted to give a shout out to Katie. She died in 2019, but she had a pretty loyal following on Twitter.
So is this a hashtag that is used out there?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a hashtag. Her hashtag was life of a fourth stager. And so that was the hashtag that she used. But it could be. It could be a hashtag that I'm not aware of. But it's kind of awesome. It's kind of fitting.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fitting.
Reflective to how one feels when it's going on.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're going to talk about nausea.
And vomiting. You know, I know we're going to say the vomiting so many times. Wait till we get to the diarrhea constipation episode.
Yes.
But I digress. Nausea and vomiting. Because they're often lumped together. And they can happen at the same time. They can happen independently of each other, and they can actually have different causes. So a person can experience nausea and vomiting at the same time, but they may not be the cause may not be related.
I think that's a really important point because you're right. They're talked about like they're one unit, nausea and vomiting, but it's not always the one thing causing it. Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's not great to have it. It's great that you.
Then I'm differentiating it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point, is my point.
Thank you.
So some risk factors when someone is going to be going into treatment. So first of all, this is the Cancer Pod. So we're talking about common causes of nausea when people are going through treatment are many of the chemotherapeutic drugs, which are actually ranked according to how much or how likely they are and how severe the nausea and vomiting may be from that drug. And a lot of intravenous agents do that. And a lot of targeted agents. These targeted agents are the ones that people take orally, right? So they swallow a pill. These are either called small molecules or targeted therapies. And, you know, you're swallowing a chemical compound. So not surprisingly, a lot of them have nausea or nausea and vomiting as a side effect. So that's true pretty much all the oral medications, chemotherapy, targeted agents, what have you. And then radiation, which often depends on where people are getting radiated. If there's radiation to the esophagus, there's radiation to the brain, the stomach, even the abdomen, there can be a nausea associated with that. Because, you know, when you think about what nausea is, not always, but sometimes nausea is a very normal physiologic response that is telling you not to eat. You know, so there are times when the body's smart and is saying, you're nauseous because I don't want you to eat. And then there's other times where I think the nausea is more of a pathology because it's laid upon you by the drugs or the radiation to the brain or whatever. And the last thing I said, chemotherapy, radiation, surgery. So the anesthesias are common.
Right. Yeah. And that was, yeah, that was my big thing, was becoming nauseated following surgeries. But talk to your anesthesiologist beforehand if you can, because my last procedure, I was fine. So make sure that you make it clear that,
yeah,
because they can work around it.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing that way.
Yeah,
I think. So the other thing is risk factors. So when people are about to get a treatment, there are certain risk factors that puts them at higher risk. And I know clinically, I always ask people what their history has been and how has their, you know, if they are someone who's prone to nausea, then they're more likely to have it. It's not a given. Nothing's a given. Whenever we're talking about risk, it's not set in stone. It's not predictive. It's just like higher risk, lower risk. So a previous history of any nausea at all, whether it's motion sickness, morning sickness, nervousness, anxiety goes to the belly, that kind of thing. Those are all things I always try to flesh out. So I know how much we want to be preventative before they even go in. And then like stats show that people of a younger age and of the female sex have higher risk. What am I missing? Anything else?
Alcohol use.
Ah.
So people who have had little or no history of drinking alcohol may have more nausea.
So teetotalers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always thought of it as like their livers aren't familiar with the evil chemicals that are out there in the world, most likely.
So we can think of alcohol consumption as conditioning, like you're conditioning your body.
No,
for
but,
the chemicals.
But don't go out there and drink a ton before you start treatment, whether it's chemo, radiation, or definitely not before surgery either.
But that's an interesting kind of statistic to say that people who don't drink alcohol are more prone to nausea. That's an interesting
nausea from chemotherapy. Yeah.
From chemotherapy specifically, because I have never fleshed that out. I mean, I didn't even know that that was the case, but it's fascinating, kind of little.
It's a fun fact.
Not so fun. Right.
So I think if somebody recognizes one of these risk factors in themselves or in somebody that they know who is going to start treatment, then you might say, I'm a little concerned, you know, talk to your oncologist and say, I was really nauseated when I had, you know, when I was pregnant or something, and definitely bring it up.
Yeah. Cause there's a lot of ways to go about preventing it, a nausea, which we're going to talk about, both drugs and natural agents, and there's ways of treating it. So it's right up there next to pain in my book. When I talk to people, I always say, you know, really there's nausea and vomiting is something we should not have to put up with anymore. Many, many moons ago, decades ago, this was part and parcel of treatment, right? People just expected to have nausea and vomiting. And I would say it's a whole nother world. It's nothing like it was, you know, even in the 1990s. So I think that still to this day, some people think treatment equals nausea and vomiting when in fact, we have so many tools at our disposal now to prevent that. I don't think anyone should have to go through severe nausea, vomiting. I think there's enough tools that hopefully we can lessen it at the very least, maybe avoid it altogether for a lot of folks.
And there are so many new drugs. I was referring to an old copy I have of a cancer management. It's a nursing handbook that I got during my residency. And I mean, it's pretty much obsolete at this point because, there are so many new drugs that are out there.
Yeah.
And so I think I'll get into the drug section in a bit, but I think people should say, you know, like, is there another option? Ask your doctor, is there another option if you find something isn't working? But, in addition to drugs, there are other causes of nausea and vomiting as well.
Yeah. And the one I think that rises to the top for me and I see most often is something along the lines of constipation, right? Mm-hmm. So for whatever reason, things are not moving through the colon. And this speaks to a nausea that is a normal reaction when your body says, don't eat, because you haven't gotten rid of what's already in there. So when you move that along and you have a bowel movement, then you're probably going to be less nauseous and maybe get more appetite back. But it's very natural to have nausea and lack of appetite when there is any reason that your bowels are not moving normally. And that could be good old constipation, like a side effect of a drug, or constipation that you've always had. But now, you know, if you're getting treatment, especially you have more toxins going in your body. So you don't have the tolerance for constipation that you might have had before treatment. And then of course there's obstructions of the bowel. So if anything is impeding the flow of the colon, that's considered either partial or complete bowel obstruction. And lack of bowel movement for several days needs to be addressed. I mean, I am still surprised at how many people will tell me it's normal for them just to have a bowel movement every third day or fourth day or something like that. And top of my list is always to get that daily, you know, daily bowel movement.
Well, especially during treatment. I mean, with any of the side effects, you really want to make sure that you get on top of it, like get ahead of it. I think that stay ahead of whatever the side effect is. And so that's why for us, like prevention is where we start.
Yeah.
Gastroparesis is kind of on that line of, you know, just your gut motility slows down and there are multiple causes for that. And but that's one that I would see quite often. There are certain chemotherapies that can contribute to that. It's the ones for like leukemia, lymphoma. Vincristine is like the big one. But then there are other things like diabetes that can slow down the gut. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing, I think, for patients. I just think it's not commonly diagnosed.
Gastroparesis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the gastroparesis reminds me of the cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome that can occur when people are doing cannabis or cannabinoids in high dose for a long time.
Are you saying that gastroparesis can be caused by cannabinoids, or it's just a similar symptom?
It's a similar symptom in that the stomach is not basically churning and letting go of its contents in a proper fashion, right? So it's similar in my mind to the idea that food is coming back up, or it's not going anywhere because the stomach itself is being affected.
Is that how that, because we've both seen this. So for if anyone has not heard of this, the cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which I'm sure there's a shorter version of calling it that. It's a long name, but it's basically like from someone using too many cannabis products. And so what I have seen is I've had patients who were under treatment for testicular cancer. And that combination of drugs is extremely harsh. And I had a patient who was using cannabis products he used them prior to being diagnosed, but he was using them to help with his nausea. Anyways, he was using it so much, it was actually the cannabis product that was making him sick. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until he cut back that, I mean, he still had issues with, you know, trying to reel in the nausea, but that was a lot of what was going on.
Yeah. And the irony of this is it can be working, the cannabis products can be working for nausea. And then if they're taken and for an extended period of time at a decent dose. So this is a kind of a chronic use thing. It has the opposite effect and people end up actually having vomiting from it. So they were using it to control nausea and it was working. And then if they do that for a long time and maybe they, you know, add other products for sleep or anxiety or whatever, it can kind of snowball and have an opposite effect and they end up vomiting from it. And of course they don't suspect it because it was a working medicine for so long for them. It takes an astute clinician usually to recognize it.
I seem to remember there is a way to see if it is the cannabis products, if that's causing the problem. If a hot shower relieves the nausea, I think that is a sign that it might be the cannabis.
I like that. That's good to know.
Yeah, it's a good little tip.
And a complete tangential aside, but it will only take me 15 seconds, I swear to God. A hot shower, you have to be careful with hot showers if you are or could be anemic, because it can make you very faint. It can make you lightheaded. A hot shower can make you very lightheaded if you're low on hemoglobin. So just a little watch out for the shower. I had that happen at least a dozen times to patients.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. So just total aside.
Okay. Wait, I have an aside.
Oh, another aside. Aside to my aside.
I have a side.
We're going to circle around.
We're going to cover all the side effects in this one nausea and vomiting episode. If you are getting certain chemotherapy agents, you may have been told to avoid heat. Don't try the hot shower thing if you have been told to avoid heat, because it can cause a rash or exacerbate a rash.
Yeah, Doxil is the really bad one for that. That could lead to a very nasty rash with Doxil. So yes, always make sure you know your avoidance.
Yeah, just don't do the hot. Drugs. Yeah, don't do the hot shower if you were told to avoid heat.
So other causes of nausea and vomiting. We talked about the bowels. We talked about the stomach basically not functioning normally. Electrolyte imbalances can cause nausea too. And that could be high calcium or low sodium, probably the two most common ones. Mm-hmm. Hyperglycemia, you know, so high blood sugar, which can particularly be an issue for people who are pre-diabetic or diabetic, because a lot of these treatments, people get steroids alongside of some of the chemotherapy drugs. So hyperglycemia is really common. So just know that that can cause nausea. So that's separate from the actual drug you're getting. So teasing these apart is not always easy to do either, right? So what's causing it? Is it high blood sugar? Is it the drug you just got? Is it something else? And of course, there's other drugs can cause it. Like I just said, hyperglycemia from a steroid or even, a pain medication. Like nausea and vomiting is a common side effect right alongside a rash from drugs, right? So these are the most common drug reactions because, again, you're swallowing a pill.
And you're often taking multiple pills. And then if somebody takes a pill, like a pain medicine, an opioid, if they take it on an empty stomach, if they, you know, that, and supplements can also trigger nausea if taken on an empty stomach.
Absolutely. Especially B vitamins and zinc. Those are the two biggies. Those
right.
Make even the hardiest stomach nauseous if they take a big dose on an empty stomach. What else? Of course, anxiety can cause kind of a nausea. You know, the other thing that I want to mention is queasiness, which kind of, some people say, well, I'm not nauseous, but then you get talking to them and they talk about queasiness. Queasiness, nausea, that early stages can also, that their gastritis of the stomach can feel like that as well. So I just want to put that out there because gastritis is really common during treatment time. So one of the things that gastritis is relieved with is some small amount of bland food. So if people feel like a gnawing hunger, or they feel like they want a little saltine or a little toast or a little banana or something just to bring that queasiness down, or queasiness, mild nausea down, that may be indicative of a gastritis. And so I just want to put that out there because it may not be nausea per se, it could be actual stomach lining irritation. Or erosion from the treatment or from, you know, a co-medication.
I think the anxiety part is really interesting. I have had several patients who said that just walking into the cancer center, even though the cancer center where I worked, both of them were just like wonderful Disneyland of the cancer center world. I mean, everybody was so friendly, and we all loved our jobs, and patients loved that they were getting treatment at such a wonderful place. But there were a few patients who they would just walk in, they would smell something, and they just become very nauseated because either they were anxious, thinking about traveling to the cancer center, they would become nauseated. I mean, these are all legit causes.
Yeah, that speaks to the hardwiring of nausea, in that they didn't experiment. And what they did was they gave people a certain scent before they gave them a highly emetic chemotherapy. And they, it doesn't matter, even if it was a pleasant scent. So some of the things they used was like strawberries. And they could elicit the nausea later with just the scent, no drug. And so what they showed is even pleasant scents can trigger, because we're hardwired to avoid those things, right? So the body's smart that way. Like, well, that made me nauseous last time, so let's avoid that, because last time I smelled that, this is what, so the nausea center in the body kind of gets triggered in a hardwire kind of way, and it will lose that over time. But jokingly, when I would tell patients this, some of them were like, so should I like take something I really love, like, you know, a cheeseburger from McDonald's or something, and smell that just before, and make my body associate that not with pleasure, but with discomfort.
Well, actually, patients are often told not to have favorite foods when they're going through chemotherapy, at least, you know, the first week or so after chemo, because not to associate it with something bad if they were to become nauseated.
Now, if that favorite food was something that's really bad for you, maybe it's not a bad thing. Well, I'm just saying, you know, we all, you got to do what you got to do to train yourself to habitually, you know, maybe, no, it's an idea. It wasn't even my idea. My patients came up with that idea.
I know. I just.
You're like, you're taking the fun out of it, Tina.
You're taking the fun out of it. Another thing, which I've had patients tell me, patients who've undergone treatment for head and neck cancer with radiation, they often have excessive secretions. And so just having all of that extra saliva causes a lot of nausea.
Yes, that is very true. Yeah. And then the last that I want to mention that I can think of is, and I think it will lead into our next topic, which is drug approaches to this, is the brain and the centers, you know, the vestibular dysfunction in the ear, or just the vomit nausea center in the brain getting triggered by the mere presence of, you know, the chemicals in the bloodstream doing exactly what it should do, which is, you know, give you the sense that there's toxicity aboard.
Acid reflux is a big cause of nausea.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that could be triggered from, it could be, oh, I have a history of acid reflux. It could be triggered from the steroids that they're given. Yeah. And that one is, I kind of think of that one as like under the radar.
Mm-hmm. I also have seen acid reflux in people who thought they were doing themselves good by doing mint or mint teas.
Yes.
And unfortunately, mint does not help with reflux. It does the opposite. It loosens up the sphincter and allows the contents of the stomach to rise up. So that's a good point. Yeah.
I don't remember if you mentioned it, but brain metastasis also can cause nausea, or brain, you know, a primary tumor. I think you did mention that before, but that's just kind of another non-chemical.
Yeah. And, you know, we should be, I just want to make sure that folks are aware that low level nausea, vomiting needs to be reported, you know, at your clinic visits, call the nurse, your nurse navigator, or whomever your, you know, kind of contact person is at the office. If it comes on quickly, you know, nausea and vomiting can be considered a medical emergency if it's severe or comes on quickly. So this is something that you should definitely not just get used to and write off, or feel like, oh, nausea, vomiting, that's part of my treatment. If it's severe and you're actually going from I feel fine to I'm vomiting within hours, or, you know, that kind of thing, go to urgent care or the ER, or call your nurse navigator at the very least, or your doctor's office. So just so we're clear, it can signify something major. Most of the time, that's not the case. And severity along with onset, you know, the quickness of the onset are the two kind of parameters to say, okay, this is something I need to get on top of now. So let's talk a little bit about prescription medications for nausea and vomiting.
Yeah. So a lot of what I did was helping patients to manage their anti-nausea medication, because before I could address it integratively, I had to make sure that they were taking their medications properly, or as prescribed, I should say. And one of the things I would explain to my patients is that the medications that they're given during their prior to their infusion, you get the pre-meds, and some of those help with the acute onset of nausea, and some of those help with the delayed onset of nausea. And so delayed is like beyond 24 hours. Different medications have different targets. So it's not like they're all the same. They're not all the same. They all have different targets, whether in your brain or in your gut. There is a vomiting center that's in your brainstem, and that gets triggered somehow by something. So you take something in, it's a toxin, it'll get triggered, but it's triggered through one of four pathways. The first pathway is the chemoreceptor trigger zone, the CTZ, and this is where there are receptors for drugs like ondansetron, Zofran, I'll use those names, Emend, and Compazine. A fun fact is that drugs in the same class as Zofran end in S-E-T-R-O-N. So if you see that ending on the generic name, you know it's in the same class as Zofran, but it can actually work differently. So just because Zofran didn't work doesn't mean another one in that same class doesn't, you know, it might work. Another pathway is the peripheral pathway, and that would be these neurotransmitter receptors in your gut. And so something like Zofran also works there. There are other drugs too. The vestibular pathway it's in your inner ear. And that is like motion sickness, like those kinds of things. You know, you're on a plane, a car, you know, you get motion sick, and that's triggered through your inner ear. The drugs that work on that type of motion sickness are diphenhydramine, the antihistamines, because that has histamine receptors. So Benadryl. And drowsiness is a big side effect of that drug, as many of us know who have had chemotherapy or have allergies. The fourth pathway is the cerebral cortex, which is the high part of your brain. And that is the pathway for things like anticipatory nausea, you know, the anxiety, the pain, the smell, the visual that triggers nausea and vomiting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so to summarize this pharmacology lesson, it's just good to know that these drugs do have their own targets. And so you're just not throwing them all out. You're not just dismissing them all.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important point, that if one drug doesn't work, because they're different classes of drugs, if one doesn't work, another one may work because it's a completely different class of drug and mechanism. So that's a good, really good point. Mm-hmm.
So that's like a huge simplification. Like I said, oftentimes patients aren't taking the pills as prescribed. Uh-huh. Most patients are told, take it, you know, at the first sign of nausea. And sometimes people are like, well, I'm a little queasy. I'll stick it out. And I always tell them, no, like, take it right away. I would have my patients take it preventively, starting mm-hmm. the day after chemotherapy. I would rather them take the medication and not experience it. And I think a lot of patients think like, oh, I made it through chemo and I didn't get nauseated, and so I don't really need these. And it jumps up on them. Maybe 3 days later, all of a sudden they're really mm-hmm. sick. Mm-hmm. And so I found with my patients, and again, don't do this at home, kids. But I found with my patients, if I talk to them about taking at least, let's say their Zofran first thing in the morning before they wake up, and if they feel nauseated before the period of time that they had to take their next one and they have the second pill, you know, take the medication as prescribed, but maybe don't wait to see if you're nauseated.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying use it more preventatively than just treatment. Don't wait for it to be an issue.
That's what I did with my patients who I would kind of go over if we couldn't figure out why their first treatment, they couldn't get on top of it. I would mm-hmm. say, okay, for your second treatment, if your nausea started in the afternoon of the second of the next day, then wake up and just take it first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
And then if they had Compazine, then I would have them take that next if the nausea came back. If the nausea didn't come back until the next morning, then that's fine. But just, yeah, kind of anticipate it, as opposed to thinking like, I'm just going to suck it up. Don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that reminds me of two things. One, this is probably why in my mind, from a clinical point of view, I do put it right next to pain, because it's similar in that approach, right? Like, don't wait for it to happen. You can preempt it and get on the medications. And really that discomfort shouldn't be there, because we have so many different classes of drugs to treat nausea, vomiting, to treat pain. That's probably why in my mind, clinically, when I listen to people and I'm listening closely to hear who just has it in them to just be stoic. And I encourage them, you know, this is no time to suck it up. This is time to use those drugs for their purpose.
Not to say that there aren't side effects with these drugs. Something like Zofran can be very constipating.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's a Leia story. My oncologist, I'm so prone to nausea. Like, I can't even do those IMAX movies. I get so nauseated just thinking about an IMAX movie. And so I don't know how out of the box this is. He had me take 24 milligrams of my Zofran first thing in the morning when I woke up. And I did that for, I think, 4 days or something. I don't necessarily recommend that because I didn't have a bowel movement for maybe a week. And when I did, it was like a porcupine coming out. It was really painful. But I was really happy because that meant I didn't have diarrhea and I also didn't have nausea. And I just dealt with the constipation, which was miserable. But I just picked my evils. So just do be aware that there are, and there are other side effects, which we're not going to go into, of these medications. Hopefully the nurse who teaches you before your treatment, you know, goes over a lot of these side effects. But the constipation is the big one. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes a patient can be taking their medication as prescribed. Mm-hmm. And they won't have any vomiting, but they still will have nausea. And that's when you got to go back and remember that they have different cause. They may have different causes. And so not to say this medication isn't working. I'm still nauseated, even though, you know, I'm not vomiting. Well, we got one thing under control. And now let's look at what is the trigger? Why are you nauseated?
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of touched on peppermint. So I think that's a perfect intro to our next part, which is integrative approaches.
Yeah. So peppermint is a very good relaxant, right? Peppermint contains menthol, and menthol is the stuff that's in all of the, you know, back in the day it was Bengay, but now there's, you know, Icy Hots and all those things over the counter that we put on our muscles, on our skeletal muscle to relax it. We do that to relax the muscle, right? So that's why we do menthol on our muscles, you know, for a tight muscle at all. So just think of that. That's how you're going to remember. You can easily remember that peppermint oil contains a lot of menthol. And that's why peppermint tea is not a great idea if you to drink that if you have reflux, which is what we mentioned earlier. On another note, though, peppermint oil, along with some other oils like lavender and rosemary, the essential oil, when the aroma of the essential oil can actually help relieve some nausea.
Yeah, those are great. Those are, and it's not ingesting. You are not ingesting essential oils. But
no,
I was gonna say, but having like to breathe in as infused and stuff.
Well, and you may have it handy because all you have to do is go to your bathroom. And if you have any of those, you know, rubbing compounds, basically the Bengays and the Icy Hots and all that menthol containing stuff we put on our muscle, that can be used as a smelling salt kind of thing. You can just take that and see if that does it. The trick, you don't have to run out or go online and buy another product. You can see if that gives you a little bit of relief. There is a product specific for this that has been used in clinical trials in a hospital setting, even called Queeze Ease. Mm-hmm. Queeze Ease is kind of a neat little product that has four essential oils in it. And it's got a little roller and a cap. And I think there's a couple different ones. There's also single use, which they're really not single use. You should probably use that same thing all week until it dries up. But Queeze Ease is a really nice product that you can find online. And these are all smelling salt kind of stuff. And I'm saying smelling salts because that's what people are used to hearing. That's how you do it. You go about using them. There's no salt involved.
Right. You waft them under your nose.
Yeah.
It's a waft.
Waft them under your nose.
I have two things along that line that also I have found that can be helpful for patients. One of them is if you have citrus, like orange, mm-hmm. peeling an orange, smelling orange essential oil can also be helpful. That's kind of a nifty little home remedy. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, it's an old nurse's trick, is rubbing alcohol. Mm-hmm. So having those little individual packets of, you know, little alcohol swabs or wipes, and I'm waving that under your nose too. For some reason, that smell can help to relieve nausea.
Yeah. And you know, as far as flavors go, the one thing that people tolerate when they tolerate very little else is lemon. So, you know, even when water tastes a little nasty, and we're going to talk about that, I know, in our next episode, but you know, this has taste changes and things like that. But just on the note of nausea, when not much sounds good going down, for some reason, lemon seems to be more tolerated or makes things more tolerable. Mm-hmm. As far as prevention of nausea, much like the drugs that they use to prevent it, the one kind of botanical medicine, plant medicine that stands out is ginger.
Yeah.
Ginger root. And ginger in any form can be useful. It could be a little ginger ale. It could be ginger tea. It could be like the hard candies that they sell.
Pickled.
pickled ginger. It could be, yeah, there's a company called the Ginger People. Or is it just ginger people? I don't know.
Oh, that's the little guy that he's a ginger root, but he looks like a cute little animal.
You got it. Yes. Yeah. And they make a concentrated ginger ale. I think it actually says anti-nausea on the can. But anything that's concentrated ginger, try to get it without anything else in it. You don't want other chemical compounds or anything. So pickled ginger, ginger tea, just buying the root and making tea, sucking on the candies. If you want to do ginger capsules, there has been really interesting information about ginger capsules and how they should be used. There's mixed evidence. And what looks like it works is when people start ginger as a 500 milligram capsule about 3 days before chemotherapy begins and take it one capsule twice a day. You don't need more than that. One capsule twice a day and then do that for 3 days until the treatment begins, and then they can take it another day or two after that, or just start move to ginger foods if they like. But that seems to be the best use of it. I know I try to get people to do foods more because there's plenty of pills going down already. So anything we can do through food is better.
And ginger tea is nice because whether it's from a tea bag or from the actual raw, the root, just because it's hydrating and it's not caffeinated. And yeah. So if it's tolerated, then it's perfect. I have actually had, I knew of someone who would take, you know, that candied ginger, you used to be able to get it at Trader Joe's. It's kind of got the sugary outside. They would put that in hot water and make tea out of that. So it was a little sweet, you know, maybe it was a little more palatable.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And as far as flavors go, generally speaking, when there is any nausea around, we're talking about, you know, the trigger zones for smell and taste can cause it to be associated with certain foods like we mentioned, or it can induce more of it if it's highly fragrant. So generally speaking, tepid foods and even colder and more bland foods can go down easier and not trigger more nausea and vomiting in the brain. And this is a moving target, right? So anyone that is a caregiver knows that someone going through treatment, it says yes and no sometimes to foods like, yo, that sounds like a good idea. But by the time that food is actually prepared and they smell it coming, they're like, I can't eat it. Right. And so it's important to do smaller portions, try to serve more bland foods, and vary it up a lot, you know, make a lot of choices. So small portions that you can take in and out of the freezer sometimes is useful for that.
And I think prepping the meals, especially if it's somebody who might be living alone, if you have good days or even before you start your treatment, whether it's, you know, chemo, radiation or surgery, but prepping meals and freezing them before you actually start treatment. So that way, if cooking bothers you, you have these meals already prepared that you can just defrost.
Absolutely.
So kind of preparing yourself. Mm-hmm. I had a patient tell me that watermelon helped them with nausea. And so they, fortunately, it was in the summer when they were getting treatment, fortunately for the fact that there were watermelon available. Mm-hmm. And they cut it up and froze it in freezer bags and then would just pull it out and kind of suck on it. And it helped them with nausea.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. That's great because it's very hydrating, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, another thing that I commonly recommend was the travel bands that hit the acupressure points on the wrist. Because acupuncture can work, right? So if you have an acupuncturist or you want to try acupuncture, that can certainly be helpful. Acupressure can also be helpful. And these bands are called C bands because they're often used for people that are going out to sea to avoid nausea. So that is something that's easy to do. And if it works, it's great. It's easy to do. You can have it around. Doesn't take much in the way of your energy or your resources.
And the point is pericardium 6, and that people at home want to try this. It's your three finger widths below the crease in your wrist. And so you'll see the lines in your wrist. Take three fingers, place it there. It's under your index finger. And if you have two tendons, it's right in between there. So even if you're not able to find those bands, you can still apply pressure on those points and you may find relief.
That's a really great tip. I love that, Leah.
Thanks. I guess a big thing is, because we talk about acupuncture so much, is how to find an acupuncturist, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my recommendation is always, you know, ask around the cancer center. If there isn't one available there, you know, see if any of the nurses, the oncologists, you know, other patients, you can ask friends, always check reviews online. If someone does refer someone, find out if they have experience with cancer patients, always. And if you're having trouble finding someone, you can look on the national, you know, the practitioner directory at nccaom.org. And typically, acupuncture depends on your health insurance, right? Whether or not it's covered.
Yes.
So for people who it's not covered on their policy, I recommend community acupuncture.
I think you have to maybe explain that for our listeners.
Oh, yeah. You know, it started, I think, in Oregon.
Did it?
I think it started in Eugene, actually.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. So community acupuncture is, and help me out if I fall here, but it's when a bunch of patients are in the same room and they're all fully clothed. It's usually just, you know, like something on the wrists, hands, maybe on the face and neck where the points are. And it's cheaper. It tends to be about the cost of a copay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, now that you mentioned that, when I lived in Eugene, there was a place called Community Acupuncture on one of the main drags. So maybe that was one of the first ones that did it. And just to be clear to everyone, you're not laying on a table and you're not disrobing. You are just sitting in a chair, and the points that they access are, you know, that's why they're doing the face or the hands or the arms or maybe the feet, but they're not doing.
Right. Yeah. You're fully clothed and it's very modest, but it is a great way to get more affordable treatments.
Yeah. And I would say, especially for acute symptoms, right? Like things that are coming on acutely, like nausea or, you know, acute symptoms in general that can be addressed with more simple acupuncture than, say, constitutional acupuncture, which does require a little bit more involved intake.
Right. And, you know, acupuncture for nausea may also cover anxiety, you know, which contributes. So it's kind of a nice tonifying treatment. So what else we got?
Yeah, let's see. Some other measures that people can take that are simple is, you know, sometimes metal utensils can trigger some nausea or make you a little more queasy. The metal, the actual metallic utensils.
Oh, like stainless steel. Yeah.
Yeah. So replacing that with seeing if something along the lines of plastic or another type of utensil might help. And one that I think is gaining a lot of attention is fasting.
The opposite of modifying your diet, fasting. Yeah.
So yeah, if it's, you know, I depends on the person. I mean, some people are really eager and can't wait to try something like this, fasting around chemotherapy, which among the many side effects that reduces is nausea. It's on the list of side effects that are possibly reduced around chemotherapy. And generally speaking, I will tell you, most of my people, I'll say fast, I'll have them not eat the day before, not eat the day of, but begin eating 24 hours after. So if they get chemotherapy from 10 to 2 or 12 to 5 or whatever, the next day at the time that they ended their chemo. And that's fairly doable for a lot of people. I also will modify that. And I know that's a little bit of a cheat, but I will do more of a vegan only 500 calories or less. So they're doing, you know, maybe vegetables and some veggie broth and 500 calories or less makes them feel like they're eating something. It's not as much food as usual, but it's still, I think, within the realm of fasting, as in it's low protein and it's low fat.
Because so the fat vegan aspect, and fat can be a trigger. So yes. Fatty foods can be a trigger because the fat slows your gastric emptying. It keeps the food around longer, and then that kind of makes you irpy.
Yeah. And fasting around chemo, I want to put one caveat to that. That is something I would do with people I know are not in any danger of losing a lot of muscle mass or are in weight loss stage. Right. So anyone with a low body mass index or BMI, I probably would not do that with. People I think are going to go through treatment and they are going to be, you know, resuming a normal caloric intake after treatment, I'm more likely to do that with. If it's someone I think they have compromised digestion or compromised intake of their calories, I would be super cautious and maybe just not do it at all.
Or history of eating disorder.
That's the other thing. Yeah. Before fasting, that's on my intake form. So
okay.
Eating disorders is something that rises to the top. And I'm very careful about dietary discussions in general, including fasting and what we call now orthorexia, which is basically orthorexia is when people just they get obsessed around food and think that there is some perfect way to eat to the point where it becomes a pathology. They can't enjoy just a normal diet.
So fun fact number two, I think it's fun fact number two, is my oncologist, when I went through treatment in 2014-15, he was running a clinical trial, a small trial at the cancer center on fasting. It was called the Stephanie trial, S-T-E-F-N-E. And it never was completed because he ended up leaving the cancer center. But he had recommended, he was like, I'm not going to enroll you for the trial, but you can try this. And they were looking at different lab works. They were looking at IGF-1. They were looking at different markers in the patients, as well as seeing if clinically they were having less side effects. And so that's what I did. I fasted 24 hours before and 24 hours after chemotherapy. And I would have broth. I actually had like bone broth, chicken bone broth during my infusion. But, and that's how I did my treatment. And it really wasn't that hard. Plus the fact that I was like sleeping through my chemo anyways. And then the next day I was pretty out of it. But my last chemo, I did have, they had gluten-free fried chicken in the cafeteria. And I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to go for the group. It's my last chemo. And so, yeah, my very last one, I had gluten-free fried chicken.
Was it good?
It was so good. So to kind of round this talk up would be addressing breath, because these all may work for certain kinds of nausea and vomiting, but for anticipatory or anxiety related nausea, breathing can help. Controlled breathing. And there's something known as box breathing. And it's very simple. You inhale for the count of four, hold your breath for four counts, exhale for four counts, hold your breath for four counts. If you can't do four counts, do two, you know, just, but it's that rhythmic breathing, and that can help to decrease anxiety.
Well, that's easy.
It's easy and it's free. And, you know, it's,
why not? I like therapies that go under the why not column.
Right.
I like that. So I think that covers our topic for today, at least a cursory view of the topic for today. I mean, I'm sure we could go in more depth on everything that we talked about, but that'll do for now.
I think so. I think we kind of covered most. I mean, we could have gone for hours about the diet aspect, but I'm sure we can leave that for another episode. Our next episode in this series of side effect. I already said it. Side effect. There, I said it again. Is going to be about mucositis and dysgeusia, or as known to the common person, the lay person, I should say, mouth sores and taste changes.
All right. Mouth sores and taste changes is our next episode, which is not too far off this topic.
It overlaps. A lot of it overlaps. Right? They do. I think this has been pretty informative. I hope people found the information useful.
Yeah, I hope this at least helps a few folks out there, at least gets people thinking about some things that might be useful for themselves or their loved ones.
So if you liked this episode, just tell us what your thoughts are. You can leave a comment on our Instagram page, send us a direct message, and hopefully we will also be doing a live, and maybe you can ask us some more questions then. But for now, I'm Dr. Leah Sherman.
And I'm Dr. Tina Kayser. And this was the Cancer Pod. Thanks for listening.